Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Listener questions, man. That's what we're going to talk about on this episode. For instance, we're going to talk about condos. We're going to talk about auto insurance and three more that I'm not going to talk about because we'll get to those in a second.
Yeah, can't give all the goods away up front.
Yeah, that's right.
And the first question we're going to tackle in just a minute is about buying a condo. And that is so different than buying a house. So yeah, parsing the particulars in that case should be a lot of fun. We'll get to that in just a minute. But Matt, before we get to these listener questions, we have to mention that Costco recently, just about a month ago, opened their first store in China and it was pandemonium. And I find that so fascinating because I myself am a huge Costco fan.
Yeah, man, this has been out there for a little bit, so maybe you've heard about it, but the pictures that they showed from that grand opening at Costco, I guess it's not surprising. Like you see video or you see pictures in particular in China of them kind of loading up on their subways or their trains. And the folks who work there in the station are literally just putting all their weight onto the last person that's trying to fit through the door so the door can close and they can, you know, kind of jam in there. So picture that, but in a Costco, right? Which is like my worst nightmare.
I have been on the subway in Shanghai.
Oh my gosh.
And it does get a little hectic. It gets a little crazy. They are actually well designed.
Oh yeah.
And the directions are fantastic around the station. But
they are not afraid of getting close.
No,
right?
Personal space is treated much differently over there. And you can tell at this Costco opening, things went so crazy. Apparently there were incredibly long lines just to try to use the bathroom and insane traffic jams outside the Costco. They had to close it early. The picture especially of folks at the rotisserie chicken counter.
Yes.
That did it for me.
Yeah, reaching for the chickens that are no longer there.
But barren shelves. It was really interesting.
My favorite quote from the whole thing was basically, like you said, they had to shut down early and they sent out a text to Costco members or Costco customers. And the text read, "To provide you with a better shopping experience, Costco will suspend business this afternoon. Please don't come." Oh man, it just totally cracked me up.
Yeah, got that out of hand.
Yes, yeah. But I mean, I love though how well, you know, some of these American businesses are doing overseas. I think it's great to see an international embrace of a company that, I'll say it, that we love so much. Even though I'm not a member, I love what Costco does, but my true allegiance does lie with Aldi.
Sometimes in our Facebook group, there are Aldi people and Costco people, and occasionally they battle it out, but they do it kindly, I would say.
It's like West Side Story.
One thing I wanted to mention really quickly about big companies, big American companies doing business overseas. We talk a lot about investing in a total stock market index fund, and we're usually talking about the American stock market. And there are certainly other ways to invest your money. You can diversify in a ton of different manners. But when you see companies like Costco, companies like Coca-Cola, companies like McDonald's, just doing insane amounts of business overseas, being well received in countries around the world, it just goes to show you that when you're investing in the total American stock market, you're not really just doing business in the United States. You're investing in companies whose profits are coming in a major way from dozens and dozens of countries around the world. And so I find that to be a comforting fact, and to see Costco being this well received in Shanghai. Yeah, it made my heart glad. And it reminded me that this investing strategy is a good one for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, that's right, man. I mean, if John Bogle is down with that method of investing, I'm down with it as well. And so let's go ahead and introduce our beer for this episode. We are drinking Second Fiddle by Fiddlehead Brewing Company. And this is a double IPA. Is this one also out of Vermont?
It is. This one's out of Shelburne, Vermont.
Nice. Yeah, this is another beer donated to the show by Cameron here in Atlanta. Man, thanks so much for this one. And I'm looking forward to sharing our thoughts on this beer at the end of this episode.
Yeah, thanks, Cameron. Can't wait to try this one out. All right, Matt, let's get to the subject at hand. We're answering listener questions on this episode. And first, to anybody out there who wants to submit a question to be on the show, we'll just follow the easy directions on our website. Go to howtomoney.com/ask. You will find the simple steps to submit your voice question to be considered for the show. And the first question, like we mentioned, is about buying a condo.
Hey, guys, it's Ike from New York. Love the show. I'm curious what you think about condos. As a young person, it seems like my options are either renting, where I'm kind of throwing money away, or owning a home and or a piece of land, which is very capital intensive, and there's all these maintenance costs that can come up, etc. Condos seem like a great middle ground. You get to work towards owning something, but on the other hand, you don't have to own the entire building and land, so a lot of the maintenance costs and etc. fall not on you. Is that true? Do you think it's a good investment? I'm hearing conflicting things from friends and, you know, people joking about it being like an old person option, but not really good for young people. Curious what you think. And then real quick, would love to hear you guys review some non-alcoholic beer sometime. Thank you.
Ike, thanks so much for the question, man. And on the note of non-alcoholic beers, you know, Joel, I have not actually had one that I thought was really great, but I am not opposed to trying one. How about you?
Yeah, no, I'm not opposed to it either. The question is there enough flavor to make it worth it? Because some of my favorite beers are incredibly low alcoholic beers, like 2 or 3%. Like there's some really good beers that are
low ABV.
Yeah, that have tons of flavor. But I've just never tasted something that was non-alcoholic that brought enough flavor to make it worthwhile. But Ike, we'll continue the search, and if we find something, man, we'll totally feature it on the show.
You know, I've been wanting to try the Heineken 0.0. Have you seen the ads for that?
Yeah.
They keep popping up when we watch our soccer matches. They kind of pop up on the screens there. I guess they're a big advertiser when it comes to soccer, but I have not had one of those either. And I'm up for trying that, though.
I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, all right.
All right, so let's get to Ike's question. We're talking about condos. And Ike, one of the things you mentioned in your question was that you feel like you're throwing away your money when you're renting. And we talked about that actually all the way back in episode 15. And we don't actually think that you are throwing your money away when you're renting. There are a lot of great reasons to own, but thinking of your home as an investment is not necessarily one of them. So we would just encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. And I think it'll make you feel better about renting even while you're considering this condo purchase.
And so while we're on the note of thinking of your condo as an investment, you know, we're thinking about value, right? Generally speaking, detached single family homes, they're going to appreciate more. However, it depends on your specific market. I'm thinking of in San Francisco, because the condos there appreciate like crazy, and they've been appreciating at a faster rate than single family homes. That being said, the increased value of your condo or of your house should not be the only deciding factor.
Yeah, and the value of condos can actually fluctuate a lot more than the value of single family homes. And part of that has to do with the fact that condos can be more difficult to sell. And part of that is the fact that you can't control who your neighbors are. They might not take care of the building in the same way you do. And also when they put their unit up for sale, if you're planning on selling at the same time, well, you have this direct competition that doesn't play itself out in the same way when you're selling a single family home. So we'll get to the reasons I think that we think condos can be a good purchase, but these are things to keep in mind before you decide that it is a great idea and make the purchase.
And then Ike, you also mentioned maintenance costs, right? And while it's true that with a condo, you don't have to think about the maintenance perhaps of the building, you are still going to be responsible for it. And that is because you pay for it via your HOA fees, which you don't often have a say in. Oftentimes that really just depends on the board. And so before you buy a condo, make sure to research the financial health of the condo complex. Your HOA fees could skyrocket. There could be a special assessment depending on the condition of the building. Just remember that these are expenses that you are going to experience, right? It's just part of the cost of admission. But it is true that it's not something that you're going to have to worry about. It's not going to be on your mind.
Well, that's true. It's not going to be staring you in the face like it is if you own a single family home. But depending on how the board is run, depending on the way the homeowners association has thought about long-term maintenance needs for the building that you're going to live in, those special assessments could be thousands of dollars. And that could be something that you hadn't planned for at all, you just didn't realize was coming, and hits you out of the blue. When you buy the condo, the HOA fees could be pretty minimal at the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, just say maybe like $200, right?
Yeah, but if they haven't planned very well and they don't want to do a special assessment on everyone and make them pay thousands of dollars, well, they could quickly bump that up to $325 a month. And it just quickly changes the dynamics of whether that condo feels like a good deal to you or not. My mother-in-law bought a condo just on the other side of the park from us here in Atlanta that she wanted to stay in when she comes to visit. She got a great deal on it, and it's been a great place to live. But the condo unit is almost 100 years old, and so they're really having to do a lot of maintenance right now. And so the debates in the board meetings about potential special assessments, well, they've gotten a little heated. And it's,
I bet those are fun.
Yeah, she loves going to those. But it's just one of those things that you have to consider, because the building needs to be maintained in order to keep the value up. But that means everybody's got to pay in order to make that happen. So it does get a little tricky at times.
Yep. Yeah, that's right, Joel. And so, Ike, these are sort of the money considerations that you're taking into account. And while that is great for you to consider, there are a couple of other things that we do want you to also consider. And one of those being how long you're going to plan to be in that location. If you don't think you're going to be there that long, we would suggest for you to keep renting. You want to keep renting unless you're probably going to be there for at least 5 years for a single family home, and, you know, even longer for a condo.
Yeah, if you're going to buy a condo, you need to be able to envision yourself there for longer than 5 years. In all likelihood, the minimum I would say is 7 years. And a good thing to shoot for is 10 years. The transaction costs involved in buying and selling real estate are huge. And condos fluctuate in value so much more than single family homes. You could buy a condo and the market could be down for quite a few years. And if you find yourself needing to get out of that condo, you could wind up losing money if you're only there a few years. So planning to stay for a longer period of time just really solidifies the fact that you're not going to lose a ton of money on your way out.
And don't forget to consider the lifestyle factors as well. Obviously, with a condo, they're going to typically be in better locations. You've got the higher density, and that can allow you to be closer to work and just other, honestly, just other fun stuff, right? When you're living in a city in particular, there's amenities oftentimes with condos like pools, gyms, different things like that. They also tend to be more social. Joel, I could picture you in a condo in your earlier years for sure.
Yeah, my sister just moved into an apartment complex that feels like a condo building. It's so nice. And they have this sweet gym, this amazing pool, and awesome common space. I could totally see myself there. And I feel like I'd have to ditch my awesome kids just because they cramp my condo living style. And I'm not willing to do that. So I'm sticking to the single family home life right now.
That being said, I'm sure there are lots of happy families who have kids, maybe who even have lots of kids, and they're in a condo. But I do think for a lot of people, when it comes to finding a home for their growing family, a condo may not always fit the bill. And something else to consider too is if you're traveling a lot, man, a condo is going to be a fantastic option for you. And a lot of that does have to do with the fact that you do not have to take care of the exterior of the home. You don't have a yard. You don't have branches that are falling on your house. There's just so much less to think about when you are only having to worry about the interior of your home versus the, you know, the whole lot.
Yeah, Matt. And you mentioned researching the financial health of the condo complex. We'll put a link in the show notes. There was this great article about how you do that. We're not going to get into all of that right now, but I feel like that'll be really helpful to Ike as he looks to buy a condo in a complex that is doing really well financially, where he's not going to be blindsided by an expensive special assessment. And by the way, Ike, condos are not just for old people, man. In fact, I don't even really associate condos with old people. I think it's funny that your friends do, but I feel like condos...
Yeah, forget those friends.
Yeah, you don't need them anyway. No, I'm just kidding. But
or if instead of calling it a condo, call it a flat. Like that's what they do in the UK. And I'll be honest, anytime I hear that, I think it sounds super cool. So.
It does. Yeah, it sounds way cooler. But yeah, condos definitely are not just for old people. They're for all sorts of different kinds of people. It just really depends on how long you're going to stay there, how much you care about the amenities and the location that you're going to live in.
Cool. So that's our first question. We're going to talk some about insurance, but two very different types of insurance right after the break.
All right, Matt, we're back and we're talking about insurance. We got two different questions back to back about two totally different kinds of insurance.
Hello, Matt and Joel. My name is Amber and I live in Denver, Colorado. I'm calling to ask if you can talk about the different auto insurance options within your plan. I have collision and comprehensive, but then there are all these other options that I'm not sure whether I need. These include bodily injury liability, property damage liability, medical payments, and uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. I didn't have collision for a while, but then I was hit by someone and had to pay out of pocket for everything for months until he could reimburse me, so I added it back. But the cost of insurance is so high that I'm not sure what to do with it. Thanks for your help.
Amber, great question. And yes, auto insurance can be really expensive. And we'll get into all the specific things that you need to consider when you're buying an insurance policy in just a second. But I want to mention at the outset that shopping around for your insurance with different providers can result in vastly differing rates. So it might make sense for you if you've been with the same provider for a while to do some shopping because you can likely cut your rate by hundreds and hundreds of dollars just by switching to a new company. So just make sure that's on your radar. And Matt, let's kind of get into the meat of the question now too.
Yeah. So Amber, it sounds like you have most of the types of coverage that are offered, right? You've got comprehensive, you got collision. Liability is required, Almost all states require that. But everything else is optional depending on the state that you live in.
Except for that weird state of New Hampshire. You don't have to have car insurance at all in New Hampshire. How weird is that?
Super weird. That completely threw me. I wonder if there's an actual good reason why they don't require it. Maybe we should look into it further one of these days.
I'm sure some listener will reach out to us and let us know.
Please do.
They're really good about that.
Let's go ahead and kick this whole thing off and talk about liability insurance. If you are at fault in an accident, liability will cover the other driver's car. That's what's considered property damage liability. Injury liability would also cover their medical bills, and that's the bodily injury part that you mentioned. Again, your state has minimum requirements, but we would recommend that you have enough liability coverage to cover your total value of assets.
Yeah, you don't want to get in an accident and not have enough coverage. That essentially leaves you and your assets exposed in the case of an accident that did a lot more damage than you're actually covered for.
Yeah, that's basically being underinsured, which we're going to get to in a little bit. But these are all very insurance-y words. Asset exposure, vulnerability. But it's true. The whole reason we have insurance is to be able to protect our assets. And we want to make sure that the insurance that we have in place does cover us in case we're at fault.
Yeah, so comprehensive coverage, it covers your car if it's stolen or if there's damage caused by storms or even if your car is damaged from hitting something like a deer. You've been there, Matt.
Yeah, that's me, unfortunately.
Yeah, comprehensive coverage is not required, but it's often recommended. It could be and likely is required, though, by your lender if you still have a car note on that vehicle. So let's say your vehicle is paid off, though, but your driveway sits underneath a massive 100-year-old oak tree.
Hey, that's also me.
we have a lot of giant trees in our part of town, Matt, and there are these precarious limbs that are essentially the size of a normal tree that just hang sideways, right?
Defying gravity, and I'm just waiting for the day for that thing to smash my car.
Yeah. So in that case, it makes sense probably to have comprehensive coverage because there's a higher likelihood of something happening that would necessitate you needing it.
And then there's also collision coverage, and this is also optional unless you don't own your car outright, right? If you still have payments on it, your lender is going to require you to have likely comprehensive and collision. But collision coverage covers the cost of repairs or replacement to your car if you're in an accident that is your fault. That coverage acts as that safety net. However, you might be asking yourself, when should I consider dropping collision coverage? A good rule of thumb is that when your premiums exceed 10% of the value of your car and you can self-insure. So for example, if the value of your car is $4,000 and collision and comprehensive premiums are over $400 annually, and you have the money set aside to be able to buy a new car for yourself, that can be a good time to consider dropping collision and comprehensive coverage.
Yeah, if you've got the money essentially to replace that car with another used car that's really similar, that's when you probably don't need it. But if you don't have the cash in the bank, it makes sense to maintain full coverage on that car. All right, let's talk about uninsured, underinsured motorist protection. It's just like it sounds. It provides coverage to you if you're hit by a driver who doesn't have enough insurance or any insurance to cover damages to your car or medical expenses that you incur in the case of an accident. And you might think that most other folks that you're driving on the road with, well, they probably have insurance, right? You might think they're responsible human beings.
Yeah, they're decent, right?
They might be decent, but they're not responsible, okay? Because they probably don't have insurance. There's a huge swath of the American public that's driving around without car insurance. In Florida, for instance, the estimates are that 26% of drivers on the road don't have any sort of car insurance. So that means that if you get into an accident with that person, you're going to need this uninsured motorist coverage.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning that hit and runs, that also falls in this category. So if you happen to be an fender bender and you do the responsible thing and pull over to exchange information and you just see that car speed off really quick, you're sorry out of luck if you don't have uninsured motorist coverage, because that's when that coverage would kick in.
I've been there, Matt. Fortunately,
have you really?
Yeah. Someone sped off after hitting me. But fortunately, it was just a little bit of damage and there wasn't even enough to necessitate a claim to insurance under my uninsured motorist protection. But it's a bummer, dude. That feels terrible.
Yeah, it sucks. So Amber, you know, the different types of coverage, how much coverage you should have, and then even what to set your deductibles at, that all depends on your comfort level with risk and the amount of cash that you have on hand. And ideally, that cash would be in your emergency fund sitting there in a high interest earning savings account.
Yeah, so there's a lot to think about. You don't want to cheap out when it comes to your auto insurance. You want to make sure that you have the right coverage for your needs, that in the case of an accident, you have the proper insurance to be able to pay for the damages. The biggest way to save money is not to skimp on coverage, but it's truly to shop with different insurance providers. So I know it's tough. I know auto insurance can be really, really expensive. but your coverage amounts are not the place where you want to dial back and increase your savings. And by the way, we have an article on the site. We'll link to it in the show notes that covers a lot of easy ways that you can save money on car insurance. And so, yeah, check that out too.
All right, Joel, we have another insurance question, but this one is about life insurance.
Hey guys, my name is David. I'm from Kansas. I had a question about whole life insurance. In my younger and less educated years, I signed up for a whole life insurance plan, thinking it was a pretty sweet deal with the cash value and all that. Needless to say, I found your podcast and started doing some research on my own and realized it was not a sweet deal. So I started putting about $150 a month into that around 2 years ago, and now I'm looking at canceling that. I didn't know, with it having some cash value, obviously the cash value is low right now because a lot of those early months go towards commissions. So I didn't know if it would be better to just cancel ASAP or to wait a little bit and let the cash value grow a bit. I think it's best to just go ahead and cancel it as soon as I can, but I wasn't sure if there was a good line of reasoning with that. Just let me know. Thanks.
David, great question. And which of us hasn't done something dumb in our younger days? So don't beat yourself up. But now that you know that whole life isn't the best decision and costs you a whole heck of a lot more than you should be paying for life insurance, it makes a whole lot of sense, in my opinion, to cut your losses and start moving on down the road to a better, less expensive life insurance product.
Yeah, David, our answer here, it's going to be pretty straightforward, but I know that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be easy. I'll touch on that in a second. But we would recommend for you to go ahead and bite that bullet, cancel that policy as soon as possible, and get whatever cash value you have out of it. The problem would be if you continued within that whole life policy, you'd be committing what's considered the sunk cost fallacy. What's done is done, and if you were to continue, you would just be throwing good money in after bad. It's tempting to want to continue to do that, right? Because in an instance like this, you've paid money towards that, and so you literally do feel invested. And emotionally, you want to continue. You either want to see it made right, or you feel that you can't leave it, because emotionally, you do feel tied to this account. But again, the best thing for you to do at this point is to go ahead and cancel that policy.
Yeah, $150 a month, that's a good chunk of change that David is essentially paying for this whole life policy that isn't in his best interest. Whole life insurance is just not a sweet deal. In almost every situation, term life insurance makes the most sense. So we have a new guide on our site about shopping for term life insurance, the factors that you need to consider, and how to go about shopping for it. We'll link to that in the show notes, but we think that's a good place to start. And basically, the biggest factor for why term is so much better than whole life insurance is because you're insuring for a set amount of time, which decreases the costs massively. Instead of $150 a month, you might be looking at something closer to a $25 or $30 a month premium because you're buying insurance for a 15, 20, or 30-year span instead of insuring the entire rest of your life. So it's a huge money saver and also gives you that peace of mind that you need to know that you're insured during pretty much the rest of your working lifetime.
Yeah. So David, it sounded like you already were planning to do that. Hopefully our answer here will give you that additional motivation, that additional encouragement to go ahead and cancel that policy. We've got a couple more questions. We've got one about a debt settlement company, and we have a listener's frugal or cheap that I'm excited to tackle, both after the break.
All right, Matt, our next question is a little bit alliterative. It's from Pete in Pittsburgh.
Oh, I like that.
Hey, Matt. Hey, Joel. Pete from Pittsburgh here. I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, and you're doing a great job. Thanks for all the advice. You guys make my drive to work a little more bearable. I have a question about your debt settlement episode. Long story short, I'm in a lot of debt, about $50,000 between personal loans and credit cards, and I tried consolidation loans and the debt snowball, but I just wasn't succeeding. A few months ago, I learned about a debt settlement, and I thought it sounded great, so I signed up for it. Then, I listened to your episode about how terrible it really was and how I shouldn't have done it, but now it's too late. I'm already working with them, and I've settled one debt already. Two more are on a payment plan, and three more are in negotiations. My question is there anything I can do now to get out of this situation, or am I stuck until they settle all of the debts I have under contract with them? Thanks for your time, and I look forward to any advice you can give me.
Well, Pete, first thing, I am glad that Joel and I, that we can brighten up your commute. Man, when I'm driving by myself, that is the number one thing that I like to do, listen to podcasts. But let's dive into debt settlement companies. Man, the reason that we don't like those companies is because oftentimes you get scammed. You'll end up paying money upfront,
which is an illegal practice, by the way.
Yeah. And then in addition to that, nothing actually happens to the actual debt that you have, whether that be credit card or personal loans, like you mentioned, Pete. And so depending on your contract or the agreement that you signed, there's a good chance that money upfront is probably gone. We would encourage you to read that fine print. Make sure you know your contract well so that you know what's at stake.
Yeah. Knowing the terms is really important. And Pete, it sounds like you might actually be with one of those incredibly rare, decent debt settlement firms. I can't be sure about that from your question, but I would encourage you to look for online reviews about this company. See what other people have to say, especially if they've taken advantage of people. You'll be able to find people writing about that online, in particular at sites like ripoffreport.com. Also, contact your state attorney general. They often have information about debt settlement companies that can be really helpful as you're doing your research. Basically, you want to get the skinny on the company that you've hired to do this work on your behalf, and you want to know what complaints are out there so that you can know how to move forward in this relationship.
Yeah, a lot of that comes down to your individual circumstances. It depends on the specific company who you're with. So Joel, let's go ahead and assume though that this debt settlement company, that they are like most of the companies that are out there and that they're not going to fulfill what they said that they're going to do.
Big promises, little follow through.
Yeah, if you've given them access to your bank account, then let your bank know that you're canceling your agreement with that debt settlement company first before you let the debt settlement company know. And if you believe that that debt settlement company will continue to debit your account, what you're going to want to do in that case is close that account and open another. You want to make sure that your funds are safe. Once you've done all of that, then you can contact that settlement company and cancel that agreement.
The biggest thing, if you're dealing with a shady debt settlement company, you don't want them to have access to your account. And if you've given them access and you don't trust them, well, you might need to shift that money into another account so that they don't have ready access to your funds. And trying to cancel your agreement, well, that can be really difficult depending on the terms that you've agreed to. And in the worst case scenario, you might need a lawyer to look through some of those terms and see if he or she can help you find a way out of that agreement. And that's why ultimately we say that people's best bet is to negotiate directly with creditors and not hire a company to do that on their behalf. You often get better terms by cutting the middleman out altogether.
Yeah, and Pete, in order to negotiate directly with the creditors, you've got to have a plan. And if that's something that you're having a tough time coming to on your own, we would completely recommend for you to check out nfcc.org. They will be able to provide you with some affordable or free credit counseling, and they can most definitely help you to put together a payment plan so that you can eliminate this debt from your life without the help of a debt settlement company.
Yeah, so Pete, best of luck in shedding this debt from your life and shedding this debt settlement company from your life. Make sure to always tell the truth in your dealings with them and to stick up for yourself. Do your homework and don't let them push you around.
And Joel, so our last question for this episode is essentially a frugal or cheap question from a listener out in California. Let's hear it.
Hello, my name's Hannah Laurie. I'm from Los Angeles, and I have a question. It's sort of like a frugal versus cheap question. I not too long ago bought an electric vehicle, and sometimes when I'm at work or at home, because there's free charging places not far away, like about 4 blocks away or 2 blocks away, I'll go out of my way to the free charging stations to charge my car for free. And so what I'm wondering is the effort to walk like that extra 3 or 4 blocks to get a free charge cheap or frugal? Is it better to just, because there's one that costs money, like right in front of my job, and then, you know, I could charge at home. But I feel like maybe I'm being cheap because it's really not that much money. It's like anywhere between $2.50 to $6, depending on how much charge I need. Anyway, I would love to hear what you guys think. Bye.
Oh man, Matt, what a great question. I think this is our first listener submitted frugal or cheap question.
Yeah, I think so, man.
So Hannah Laurie, this is a really fun one to tackle. It is something, honestly, when I first got my Nissan Leaf that I struggled with quite a bit. It was a little bit different scenario than yours. But for me, there was a quick charge station about a mile from where I worked. So it was a little bit further out of the way. And sometimes the wait for that quick charging station could be 30, 40 minutes. And I just wasted a lot of time to save a couple of bucks and get a free charge. And it took me a few weeks to realize that charging at my house just made so much more sense. It was pretty inexpensive. So for me, I was being cheap by spending so much time waiting in line to get a free charge when it just fit into my life so much better to just plug in at home. But I feel like your situation is a little bit different. So Matt, let's take this on. What do you think? Is Hanalori being frugal or cheap in this instance?
Well, first, I want to direct our listeners to episode 43. That was when we actually did the episode called Frugal versus Cheap, or Frugal, or Are You Frugal or Are You Cheap, right? And in that episode, we were able to identify a few things to consider when you're looking at these different purchases. So one of them is the quality of the product that you're purchasing. Let's ask that question. Is the quality of the free charge worse than the quality of the charge that you're going to get at work or at home? Probably not, right? It's the same electricity. I'm guessing even the charger might even be the same. So if that's the case, there's no difference in quality. And then something else is the social implications. Your coworkers, they might think it's weird that you're walking up to the office, or, but as long as you're not damaging those relationships and imposing sort of your frugalness on them.
Yeah, like making someone else drive you to work because you're trying to get that free charge and park super far away.
Yeah, totally. That would 100% be a case where you're frugalness, or your cheapness in that case, is being imposed onto others. So that leaves the final factor to consider, right? Like the last filter. And that one's based on time. Really, it's the only consideration left. Some would say that you are wasting time having to walk 3 or 4 blocks. But I see that as a benefit. You're able to get the blood flowing before and after work. You can even see it as a small but simple and easy way to get some exercise. And it doesn't just have to be a physical break, but this can be a break for you mentally. I know for me personally, it's always helpful for me to have a period of time, say after work or after having a conversation, where my brain can essentially unpack some of the conversations I've had that day. So for me, having that space mentally is incredibly important. So essentially, instead of seeing that 3 to 4 blocks as wasted time, you can see that as a time to decompress after work, or, you know, once you're going into work, that's a time where you can kind of get into that working mindset while at the same time saving a few bucks.
Yeah, it's this awesome little buffer zone where you have those few minutes built in, that transition time, each and every day on your way in and out of work. So I like that. I like considering that time as meaningful and important and assigning some value to it, as opposed to thinking that it's just wasted. So yeah, I think ultimately this is a frugal decision. If there's a place a few blocks away from where you work where you can charge for free, well, I would do the same thing. I would park a few blocks away, I would make that walk every day, and I would save that money. This could easily end up being a good 15, maybe 20 bucks a week for you back in your life by taking advantage of the free charging that's just around the corner. So yeah, I really like the idea.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, man. I think this is a huge frugal win. I would be doing this every single day. Hanalori, you didn't mention how long it would take you to actually get one of those spots. This is also assuming that you're not having to like circle the block 20 times waiting for someone to leave where a spot would open up, right? Ugh,
like I did all those years ago. It was such a waste of my time. I would never do that again. But if the spots are readily available, I say make it happen.
Yeah, and that is frugal.
Sweet. All right, Matt, we had an awesome beer on the show today. Second Fiddle by Fiddlehead Brewing Company. Listener Cameron donated this one to the show. What did you think of this one, man?
Well, man, I liked it. I'll say that. And I'll start with the name, Fiddlehead. It makes me think of ferns, right? Fiddlehead ferns are green, which makes me think of organic matter, which makes me think of hops, like just green flavors, hops, all this kind of flowing together. This was a big old double IPA. The way I was tasting it, man, I didn't pick up on a lot of fruit flavors. I feel like it was predominantly just sort of like malts and hops, more like a classic IPA, but with this being a double, it definitely had a lot more flavor than you would get out of a traditional single IPA. But I really dug this one, man. I'm really glad we got to share it. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, man, I thought this beer was super aromatic, and I felt like that really drew me in. When you draw the nose in, it kind of makes your mouth water in anticipation of the flavor, which is always a good sign. I thought the flavors were a little more subdued than the heady topper flavors from last week, but really the beers don't compare to each other. They're both fantastic in their own right. And this beer, although it didn't have quite the epic flavor notes that I thought Heady Topper presented, it was still jam-packed with flavor, and it was its own unique offering. I really, really enjoyed this beer, and I felt like it was totally in that line of Vermont IPAs. They really do stand out, and they've kind of got this flavor profile of their own. This one was really, really good. Big thanks to listener Cameron for donating this one to the show. We really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, and if you happen to be in Vermont like Cameron was, make sure that you look up Fiddlehead Brewing Company if you're in the area. Man, I'm definitely going to add this one to my list to check out.
Man, in Vermont, you can literally just put a blindfold over your eyes, walk in one direction, you're bound to hit a brewery within 5 or 6 minutes.
What a wonderful place to live.
Yeah, I haven't even visited there, man. That's on my to-visit list for sure. All right, that was a really fun listener question episode. We'll tackle 5 more in 2 weeks. And if you have a question for us that you'd like to submit to be on the show, well, it's super simple to do so. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. The easy steps for doing so are listed right there.
Yeah. And if you have enjoyed and have found this podcast or this episode helpful, we would love for you to leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen. So Joel, until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.